Lots of you listeners at home, as well as our guests, always ask us how we run the show when we've got a guest joining us remotely from elsewhere in the world. And our secret is a really handy piece of software called Riverside FM, who are kindly sponsoring today's episode of Social Minds. We rely on Riverside FM to make sure that even if we're talking to Oatly in Copenhagen or Netflix in LA, the audiovisual quality is as high as if they were sat opposite me in our Manchester or London studios. As well as that, Riverside has a bunch of AI integrations that let us keep promo at a really high level with auto transcripts, subtitles, and its Magic AI Clips tool. It's adding new features all the time. Some of its latest updates include customizable silence removal, which lets you choose your video's pace from upbeat to conversational, and the option to add text on your videos. So its tech capabilities for podcasting are fantastic. And if you're interested in starting a podcast, I would absolutely recommend it. But even if you don't have a podcast, Riverside FM does lots more than that. And it can support you in producing everything from virtual events to webinars and panel discussions, all in 4K video paired with studio quality audio. So whether you're a marketer, a podcaster, or a creator, have a look into it and see what Riverside FM can do for you. Click the link in today's show notes to get an exclusive 15% discount on any of Riverside's available plans using our discount code SOCIALMINDS. And let us know how you get on with it. Now, on to today's episode. Once every few years, a brand manages to break out of its category and break through the noise on social. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, it's probably because that brand has found a way to zig when we've all been zagging. And hopefully, with their lessons, we can all be pulled out of the ad funk the industry finds itself in at that time. My guest today, John Thornton, has lent his creative know-how to not one, but two of those rare brands. He was an SMM and copywriter at Innocent Drinks for 4.5 years. And for the last 2 years, he's been senior creative at Surreal, who you'll probably know from one of their many viral billboards that are never not doing the rounds on LinkedIn. I'm also joined by our ACD, Jake Thompson, part-time cereal enthusiast and full-time brand and creative expert, to find out from John how he continues to put a protein cereal at the top of the newsfeed. In this, we learned the reason self-awareness has more impact on Gen Z than storytelling, why your brand is probably over-strategizing, and why building content on soft outrage and a this is from a marketing team mentality are what consistently creates those mini to mega viral moments. So whether you're a marketer, a podcaster, or a creator, have a look into it and see what Riverside FM can do for you. Click the link in today's show notes to get an exclusive 15% discount on any of Riverside's available plans using our discount code SOCIALMINDS. And let us know how you get on with it. Now, on to today's episode. Well, John, welcome to Social Minds.
Oh, thanks for having me.
As always, we have a big question for you. And the question for you is, do social audiences ever actually care about product-focused content?
I think they can care. You've kind of got to make them care. Unless you're sort of Apple or PlayStation, they're probably not going to care by default. I think if you play into why they're going on to social, then you can make them care. If you're like, basically they're going on for laughs, don't they, or distraction. And if you make it silly enough, then they might care.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. Do you agree with the sort of best practice on social that you have to ratio those product-focused posts whose goal is just to sell something to them with like more culture-led posts, like reactive content, stuff that's purely there to entertain, so your feed isn't just product, or if you're adept like you guys are at making people care about the products, could every post hypothetically be a product post, but it's just not that really direct boring sales language we're used to seeing?
So when I worked at Innocent Smoothies, we had like three pools of content, which was nonsense, which had nothing to do with product. I guess there's this other pool of content, which is like stuff a business wants you to talk about, which, so Innocent Smoothies, that might be like recycling.
Yeah. Or is it like CSR and all those? Can we post about this on our social channels?
Exactly. So that, those are kind of like the three pools, and it was meant to be like 40, 30, 20% split. That might not add up to 100. I can't remember. But I always broke and did way too much of a nonsense. That was the stuff like, that was the easiest stuff to get the clicks from, right?
And more fun to do as a creative, right?
Yeah. I guess what we kind of found was actually when you nail the product stuff, that's the stuff people actually like the most. So it's harder to do if you manage to get product content doing really well. That's the stuff people actually like remember much more than the just like random what your favorite biscuit says about you style content.
Why do you think that is, I guess?
I think it's because the sort of random content, you're almost like trying to position your page as like a meme page, whatever. Mm. And so it kind of probably all just sort of slips into the same part of their head as about other stuff. I don't really remember it's come from Innocent Bees or Surreal Cereal or whoever. Whereas when it's product focused, they do remember who it's from. And also, I think because they're so used to seeing so much boring product stuff, they're sort of, when someone manages to make one stand out, it sticks in your head much
more.
I think there's also a thing where people who don't work in advertising, don't work in marketing, whatever, they understand the people who do work in marketing have to do that job. And actually, they sort of understand the brief. And if they're like, yeah, no, you've made a good advert.
Yeah.
They credit respect where credit's due.
Comments are so savvy now. They're like, social media manager needs a raise. Like, yes.
And that sort of comment pops up all the time on stuff. Like, people are very consciously aware that there's a social media manager doing that stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas maybe with like other forms of advertising, you don't really watch a TV advert and be like, oh, the director.
Congrats to the whole team, the producers. Yeah. No, I think that's pretty blah blah, and especially when it comes to like remembering it, having the product there, like that's the part that you want them to remember. But I have this theory that, I don't know if this is the same for you on like your personal socials. If I'm posting something on Instagram and it's something that isn't me, it doesn't do very well. If it's something that is me, it always does better than if it wasn't. And it's because people follow me or, you know, whoever it is to see that. So I think it goes the same for brands as well. If they're following a brand, they're already pretty big fans. Like, it takes a lot to follow a brand, so surely seeing the thing that they're known for is what's going to get the biggest reaction, unless it's like, I don't know, exceptions to the rule, like Paddy Power, who you probably follow to see like memes and jokes.
Yeah, and I guess you might like a brand, you might not want to see just like shiny studio photography,
yeah,
all of that stuff each time. I think that's the when you just get given sort of, cause sometimes on freelance work I've just been given a rare, like, these are the photos we want to post this month on Instagram, can you just write the captions? And I'm like, I can, it's not going to do very much.
No one's going to read it.
Like, so it's easy work and money for me. But yeah.
Yeah. Whereas actually, when the process is like idea first, then image and caption and everything else second, that's when the stuff works better.
100%.
Yeah, I guess it's like the idea that you've got to earn your place in that feed, and make it feel less transactional. Mm. I guess. I guess like kind of leads us on to that fake celebrity ad campaign that we saw. Can't not mention it. Obviously, that was a product focused execution. It started out as this out of home spot, and I guess you kind of, in your experience at Innocent as well, saw a similar kind of thing work with the It's Blue campaign, again driving virality. I guess the question is, are those two kind of exceptions to the rule, or is there a formula brands can use to kind of make product posts go viral? I guess
the celebrity one, I would say, was less producty. That was more just kind of like brand. It did happen to have like the product in, but it wasn't sort of about the product. In the video, it was a little bit more, I suppose, they are referencing the product. Yeah, whereas the blue one, I felt, was like much more product, but equally it still had all the sort of innocent personality tone that you'd expect from like non-product stuff. So I think that's part of, like, there's not exactly a formula, but I think there's common stuff you would see pop in like all sort of really successful social campaigns. I think the main bit is almost going back to what you're saying about give a social media manager a raise, where you're like able to feel the social media manager. Mm. So if you look at like, well, I would say some of the biggest ones, the Greggs vegan sausage roll, Aldi Colin Caterpillar, the Weetabix beans thing. Yeah, I know, Weetabix.
beans.
They all have that kind of sense that someone's gone a bit rogue and isn't really doing what they're meant to be doing. Kind of like breaking the established rules of how companies behave.
But that couldn't be further from the truth. Like, we spoke to Weetabix about beans on Bix, and they were like, months of planning went into that.
I guess it's the output, isn't it? I know, it'd be interesting to get your perspective on this. Like, it feels like time between it's like the first pancake, someone's just pushed out live. Mm. And I think the audience see that and see that it hasn't gone through like a process of being generalized, which is usually what happens in campaign planning. It gets, there's too many cooks. So maybe, again, back to the idea of authenticity that we were kind of touching on.
Yeah. Michael said, I always want to call him Ryan. Michael from Ryanair, ex-Ryanair now, said that the window seat one where they just pointed it out, they went through like different iterations of that, with it being like a perfectly, you know, drawn circle on Illustrator. And they were like, no, let's just do it on Word Paint, Microsoft Paint, and make it look as bad as possible. So even though it has gone through teams and multiple layers of approval, it looks like someone has, like you say, gone rogue and just put it out themselves.
Yeah, we did one. My colleague accidentally changed the Innocence movie profile picture to a picture from his wedding.
Oh yeah, I remember
and
that.
Then to really add to it, he did that like literally the last second before he went on holiday, because he was trying to, I can't even remember what he was trying to do. He was trying to link the Instagram and Facebook account or something, and just like pulled his picture. And he didn't notice and left.
What an exit.
Boss texted me the next morning, he's like, have you seen what he's done? And then we're like, well, that's funny, let's keep that up.
It's brilliant.
When we spoke about it, because we wanted to draw people's attention to it, but instead of doing like a perfectly branded innocent font post thing, we just used the Apple Notes app.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
that's what celebrities use when they've disgraced themselves. Yeah. I think part of it is just finding ways that people are used to being like, oh, I'm going to read this. So like fake WhatsApp conversations work so annoyingly well because they take like no effort. But the same with like this Notes app thing. We just put an apology on a Notes app.
I guess it's because like they don't expect brands to show up in those places. Like it feels too human in a way. And I think that's maybe that's what people like about the celebrity ad campaign and its blue campaign and things like that. It feels very human. It feels like one person's come with that idea and it's gone live rather than months and months of endless production and things like that. Connects with people a little bit deeper, I think.
Yeah, and I think it also feels like coming from a person who you would, like, not like a work person, but like the version of your mate you would see in the pub, not the version of your mate you would see at work.
Yeah.
Thing. I guess in our industry, it's a bit easier to kind of still be yourself at work. Some of my friends have to be very different people in the office. There's some where like, I can't imagine what they're like in the office.
100%, yeah.
But that kind of way where people are always like, oh, if I worked for a company, that's how I would be.
Obviously, I guess with all that, those examples that you mentioned, there is risk there. I think a lot of brands listening will be thinking, did it work? You know, what was the impact? How do you judge kind of when the risk is worth taking? I guess that innocent example was a really good one. There was a judgment call that we're going to stick with it and we're going to run with it. So I guess thinking back to the surreal example, what was the impact of that? And I guess, you know, with a bit of time between on reflection, is there anything you do differently? Is there anything you would keep the same? I don't know.
Maybe that one was slightly more risk.
You got a cease and desist. Yeah. I'd call that risk.
Yeah, I didn't think I would.
That's but what like, we're all secretly didn't aiming for.
The innocent one I would argue is like zero risk. Like,
yeah.
There's this like area of what people think is risky for a business to do and what's actually risky for a business to do. And there's a big area in between where like businesses are scared to go, but which is like totally fine. Yeah, like messing around with fonts and brands.
Even just looking stupid.
Yeah, exactly. Or like not being just perfectly happy and shiny the whole time. Yeah. In terms of a celebrity campaign doing differently, I think actually one of the main things we got right was basically my test for what names to include was, will my mum have heard of them? Will an American have heard of them? Because there's lots of like, say like Team GB people who maybe my mum will have heard of, but they won't mean anything to an audience outside of Britain. Equally, there's some sort of big names that maybe my mum won't have heard of. But what, I guess what that did is that did allow it to have the like potential to go really big. And I think I sort of try and do that with everything. I basically assume everything is going to go like absolutely massive.
So always prepare for virality.
Yeah, you try to, because I think if you don't do that, then it's basically never going to happen.
Yeah, you've got to try and squeeze as much out as possible. Yeah, you've got to give it the best fighting chance.
Be shooting for it, even though it's not going to happen.
The American test is a good one, though, especially like for a consideration for a global campaign or what you hope to have global reach in a campaign, because you're right, like some of the biggest UK celebs, Americans might still not have heard of, and then like it misses that huge chunk of people, especially if you're posting it on something like LinkedIn, where I know your ads get a lot of their attraction, like actually from that industry-led like B2B crowd. The algorithm doesn't seem to care if you're American or English, or at least mine doesn't. So yeah, really good consideration. I know you said earlier how you wouldn't consider it a product ad per se, more of a brand ad. In hindsight, do you ever wish it had been more product focused because it went viral? So now you're thinking, you know, is there anything now, you know how many eyes have been on it, you think, oh, I wish we'd told them that?
No, because I guess the easiest bit would have been to just force the word protein in next to the word cereal. Felt like it like depends like suffocates it. It just felt like one too many messages.
Yeah.
We had this, my last job where they kept wanting us to just mention vitamins, and just having to put like vitamin packed smoothie in your headlines.
Yeah,
just like,
sometimes makes it read so unnatural. Yeah,
also, it takes away the assumed knowledge, right? Talking about cereal is a natural thing. Protein cereal is a new thing. So if you insert that word, it already feels like an ad.
100%. You'd have to change the copy to like, it's Dwayne Johnson's favorite cereal to Dwayne Johnson's favorite protein cereal, as if he has more than one. It doesn't,
And it wasn't about protein. Any like extra superfluous stuff dragged it down. It was purely about, we've got these normal people to say these things. Basically, our two main messages are low sugar, high protein. And except in the actual line where we have a tagline or whatever, which is high protein, low sugar, I probably only pick one that I have time to talk about. Otherwise, it just slot.
And I guess people, you know, it being someone's favorite cereal kind of supersedes that anyway, right?
Like 100%.
It's great that it's both of those things, but it's got to taste good.
No, definitely. But like, I know all our listeners will empathize with this. Who hasn't been told to put multiple key messages into one thing?
Try and say it all at once.
Exactly. If they don't listen to me or Jake, it's nice to get experts like yourself on who've had huge success like with this campaign, so hopefully they'll pay attention when you say it.
Especially on social, right? You can be posting like out every day, a week, 52 weeks a year. There's plenty of time to mention that other message.
Yeah. Yeah.
You might be able to say it more than once as well.
Yeah, you're crazy. Lots of room. Okay, so I know a lot of your immediate experience has come in like the food and drink sector. Arguably, I think I'm biased. I love working on food and drink clients. I think there's a lot of space to play in there. For any listeners or any marketers who might be wondering how they can have a similar success story, but perhaps don't work in food and drink or work on something a bit less sexy or a bit more boring, what would your advice be to them on how to, as you said, make the audience care about that product?
They don't have to care about the product so much as care about you trying to make them care about the product, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
So a lot of our stuff at Surreal is almost like, we almost present it as, we're a marketing team trying to get attention. Here's how we've done it, how we've tried to do it this time. And it happens to be that we're trying to get attention for this cereal. But sort of almost like, this was the brief. We've got to try and get attention for this thing and that thing. But you can kind of roll out to other things. You can be like, you know, if you're a mattress company, you can be like, right, well, it's Valentine's Day. A lot of people might be expecting, might be expecting stuff tonight. So a good chance for us to advertise mattresses is how it is. They're probably not going to care about like the spring loaded or whatever, but they'll care about the team trying to sell some mattresses.
Yeah, for sure.
Again, because what we talked about before, that idea of credit, acknowledging that, you know, you're a brand on social. I know you're here to sell to me, but I can see you making an effort.
Yeah.
And so kudos for that. I'll allow it.
I also think I would say generally posts about a more boring subject with the effort put in do better, certainly better than you'd expect. Maybe not better than like something exciting.
Yeah.
So like at Innocent, we had one where, again, it was like a, can you post about this? They'd got the yellow bins in the toilet so people could to safely dispose of needles if they like had to inject insulin and things like that. And they're like, can you post about this? And I'm like, you want me to post about a bin? And like the first post someone wrote, it was like 400 words and it had the full talking about like, oh, back when we started in 1999. Yep. I was like, it really is not relevant to this.
Most of your audience weren't born.
And we're just getting started. That's my pet peeve.
Because the reason they wanted to talk about them was they thought it might be like helpful for other businesses to get them.
It's like a thought leadership kind of piece.
Sort of, yeah. Which for our Facebook audience, I'm like, I don't know how much they care about that. But we just added this little line at the end. It was just a short, oh, we've got these bins. They help people with diabetes who have to inject insulin. They might be good for your office. Look how happy Connor is with them. And we had this picture of Connor who used to use them because he injected. We had about 10 photos of him posing with them, just doing this like lovely photo shoot where he's like staring lovingly at the bin. It all just looks ridiculous. And because it's so obviously a boring thing,
but
we're sort of taking a piss out of ourselves and out of it and all that, people like loved it. It got like half a million views for a bin.
I can see why.
Basically my tactic when I have to post about something I don't want to post about is to take the piss out of it in a way where I hope the person who's asked me doesn't realize I'm taking the piss, but where I definitely am taking the piss out of them.
Makes me think about where it originated from, but there's like a small skip company. How they were trying to show the different sizes of skips is they had like this older woman that worked for them. She must have been in like 60s and she just stood in the skips. So it was just like her getting smaller and smaller and a bigger and bigger skip, and it went everywhere because, again, it's how boring to skip, but it was just this sweet lady advertising how big they were.
I love
it was
that
great.
Though, when they like leverage how much you might love the person they've chosen to be the protagonist. Really rogue branches of Marks and Sparks do it. They get their really old lady employees to obviously film this horrendous out of time TikTok, but just the crowd goes wild. I can understand why.
I'm like, oh, I'm going to go and buy those crackers now.
Yeah.
Because Doris told me to.
I definitely need some Percy Pigs. I'm getting ahead of ourselves a bit while we're on the subject. Jake and I have this theory that very like millennial era marketing. Every brand needs a story. Every product needs a story. So it's like, these are not just sneakers. They're like serving homeless people because we, you know, decided there was a gap in the market for sneakers that help the homeless. And it'll be everything, whether it's like toothbrush, a plant pot, glassware, they all had a story. But that isn't working anymore. And I guess what's replacing it is what we've just been talking about, that very self-aware led marketing that Gen Z in particular seems to really respond to. So I guess the question is, why do you think, sort of aside from some of the reasons we've just touched on, why do you think that self-awareness is now more effective than that storytelling angle that was once really effective? And is there ever, I suppose, a time that it does more harm than good? You say like when we're taking the piss out of certain messaging or certain items, if you're a small run team or if you know you're a well-trusted team, brilliant. But say, for example, one day shareholders come in and they might not agree. So where is that line?
The line's pretty far for like self-awareness. I'll often use it to basically address some quite obvious flaw in a post. post. So like there was a couple of weeks ago, did this really corporate looking statement about how we deleted a tweet in inverted commas. And then as you went through it, the tweet was literally just the information that we are now in Sainsbury's. And I literally wrote like, the reason we deleted it is because when companies post serious sounding statements about deleting tweets, they get loads of attention and we want attention. And then I knew I'd basically get some comments about how I'd tricked people into reading it and it was like misleading or whatever. And so then I just like added in a question of like, is it a good idea to trick your audience into reading things? Probably not. And all of it, and just kind of like went down that bit. And because then you can't be like, they can't really criticize you for doing it.
Because you do it yourself.
Yeah, you've owned it. It's like, you're going to have to find some other thing to criticize me for. So I think that's where self-awareness is like really useful.
And why do you think it's more effective now than say that old millennial storytelling type angle?
I feel like all the paid ads from like D2C companies I get, including like we do some of, still very story-led. And it's like, oh, I've always loved having a poo, but all these toilet rolls hurt my bumhole, which is why now I've invented like silk sheet toilet roll.
Yeah,
like,
you do still see things like that.
You do see it, but the style has maybe changed, where it's now very like,
well,
lo-fi.
Even that example, which there. You know, I've seen that advert.
One of his favorites.
I guess even like it's still storytelling, but I think now it's more real in a way. Mm-hmm. Like it's talking to real things.
What did when, you say? You were like, when it's stretching the bounds of what a brand actually is.
I think traditionally it's always been about how can we make ourselves relevant to that person. And the old approach was to go and look at everything that person cares about outside of the product and just align ourselves with that. We'll sponsor their favorite sports team. We'll show up in all these other places. Whereas it kind of feels like this generation, which are a bit more discerning, have a much lower tolerance for bullshit. They can see through brands that are doing that because it's so transactional. And actually, they just want to know that you understand the issue that your product can solve for them and just tell them that, and that's fine and that's enough.
Yeah, and also that it's not like
that deep.
Unless your product is like,
yeah, that's it.
Unless your product is literally like changing something huge.
Exactly, yeah. Like the majority of products. I saw a TikTok go viral recently and it was great because I saw both, this is how reliable the algorithm is, I saw both within like 40 seconds of each other. And the first one was, did anyone see the chocolate covered strawberries video? It blew up. All it is like a fun shooting star with a song behind it. And this social media manager, she was being filmed doing it with a tray of Korean barbecue because she worked at this Korean barbecue restaurant. So you see her doing the thing. That obviously, that one blew up. And then a few videos later, I saw like the POV of the barbecue one. Also got like 2 million likes. That is so lo-fi. And I think to your point, they just love seeing the person behind it, seeing the effort like going into it. That's so much more believable and so much more likable than trying to say, this is not just any Korean barbecue. You know, this Korean barbecue is solving a real world issue. It's not that deep.
I wonder if there's like a way to compare it to the kind of TV and things that Gen Z are watching as well. Point I'm trying to make is farming as I'm saying it. But this idea that TV shows now tend to be a lot more real and flawed, like characters have a lot more depth to them.
We couldn't handle complex characters.
Yeah, it's kind of like very cliche and it's kind of very smooth around the edges.
Archetypes.
Yeah, whereas now it's the humanity. People maybe want brands to have flaws and imperfections as well.
I think that's such an interesting point because even when you're doing like a brand book or like a tone of voice book, one of the like tricks of the trade is to give them a character archetype. But you're right, it's like putting them in that sort of box where there's not much
it's always a
breathing
positive.
Space for
it's
that
always
humanity,
like,
is there?
They save the world every day with this toilet paper.
Mm.
And it's like, but actually, they really, really are rubbish at replying to texts.
Yeah.
And also on that character point, whereas TV characters will go through all the emotions, right? They might show it differently to a different character, but like, you know, Homer will be happy, angry, sad, and all sorts of whatever other emotions exist.
I don't know, right?
But then brands, especially so like you were saying in food and drink, all food and drink brands are just these like happy, clappy.
Yeah.
The smoothie company, there was a point where they shifted and they had this rule where you weren't allowed to be negative about anything. Like if it was raining, you were meant to be like, oh, well, it's good for the flowers.
Mm.
And you're like, okay, well, what happens if you step in dog shit? That's not good.
Yeah.
And it made it like impossible to talk about stuff because like you're trying to talk about like recycling or carbon or whatever. If you're not allowed to talk about the negatives.
It makes the subject quite difficult, especially when the mood of the nation. Like imagine employing that strategy like right in the middle of off the back of COVID.
Yeah.
Well, it's very British. Let's just pretend that this bad thing is happening. We'll just move on and bottle it. This is turning into therapy now.
Increased exposure. It's really interesting. Like I do find that sort of brand character stuff interesting. Kind of my bag. But with that overexposure to really happy, quite false messaging all the time, if someone in your life was communicating that way to you constantly, even
you
if like the mood
you,
was
you,
bad,
you wouldn't believe what
you'd
they were
get
saying.
Really sick of it and you'd tune out. And I think it's exactly the same.
And yeah, so like then that's real. One of the first things I did, because we had one bit of a tone of voice called the agency had done. They did a really good job on the branding. There was a line about just like being happy about it. everything. I just took that line out and was like, we're going to be sarcastic and cynical.
Yeah, we're not great in mourning.
Executive decision. So talking about maybe the differences between surreal and innocent, how much of surreal's content would you say is guided by that strategy and more of like robust guidelines, say, compared to innocent, who I know their tone of voice training is militant. I'm not sure. I don't know much else about the actual strategy behind it, but is there much of a difference there? Is one more strategy heavy than another?
I think when I was at innocent, I don't remember ever seeing a written social media strategy. There was stuff like in my head, I mean, in my boss's head. I would say it was like there's method to
it. Was that by design?
Elderly says the same thing. It's wild how much I'm hearing this recently.
But yeah, like the more general tone of voice guidelines, there was like a 40-page document.
Yeah.
But yeah, actually on social, yeah, we didn't really have big picture strategy. My old boss would hate me for saying that. We had much more of like almost, again, a social tone of voice, but more like this content worked, this content didn't work.
Yeah.
This content upset a few people, like talking about like the Grand National or things like that. So we're like, okay, we're not going to talk about that. Or like just taking this slightly strange way into a subject works really well. So like we'd always talk in this sort of almost wildlife documentarian voice for certain things. If there was a heat wave, day four of a heat wave, Britain's doing this and that and that, which isn't like our normal tone of voice, but it always worked. So we had that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I would say that Surreal is slightly more strategy on social than at Innocent, because at Innocent, literally the strategy was to appear like there was no strategy.
Yeah.
But really the strategy at Surreal is I basically learned that because product stuff, if you get it right, does better than non-product stuff. The strategy is just to try to get product stuff right every time, more or less. Sometimes I'll still think of something funny, pretty unrelated to product. Basically, my strategy is to be that weird cereal company. I either try to do something which is weird and cereal related, weird and company related, cereal and company related, or just weird cereal and company related, like ideally all three.
No, I think it's a real testament. It is working. It might be, you know, at the point where, you know, give it 5 years and Surreal has to scale a lot more. It might be that you need to bring in something a bit more traditional. I hope not, but it seems to happen.
It's when you have to start explaining that to more people, isn't it?
100%,
that's when you need those written things.
It is very rare that you see brands doing product posts well. And I think what I'm seeing a lot is sort of what I said at the beginning, where they feel like they have to ratio it with memes, etc., for them to be listened to, when in fact you're proving the opposite. A follow-up question there. Again, it's one that Jake and I have a bit of a working theory on, but we're biased as creatives. You may also be. Brands can over-strategize. Agree or disagree?
Based purely on the fact that I have very little strategy, I'm going to agree.
Same.
They can probably under-strategize as well, I would guess. Maybe at times we have done that.
Okay, what do you think that in your experience of working in places that perhaps don't have much strategy to guide you and the content output and what's going on, versus knowing instinctively you can over-strategize? Are there certain things that you as a creative want to see those guidelines, you know, in place for? Things that you think have to be in place in terms of rules or pillars or things to do? And then some things that you would see in a common strategy that you think absolutely don't need to be in there.
We have a pretty liberal approach to sign off. Basically, in a sense, real, I can post something without anyone sign off. But so having the stuff in place before that, so I know what is and isn't appropriate. So for instance, Innocent, it was just like, don't talk about politics, which is sometimes annoying for a company which appear quite like left-leaning or whatever.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, so we can't, but whatever. But yeah, so kind of knowing what areas are completely safe to play in, what areas I should maybe check with my boss, what areas we'll maybe want to check with my boss's boss. Understanding that is, I think, important. I think that's kind of a main thing, to be honest. I love it. It's like common sense stuff. We'll take the mick out of ourselves, but we won't take the mick out of product. Yeah, but that's basically the one line I wouldn't cross.
Yeah. But those lines need to be like written down somewhere, I guess. Because as you said, like if they weren't and you went out with something that crossed that line, it's going to blow back on you.
Even though we'll talk about having like very little strategy, we always knew why we were doing something.
Yeah.
I think I broke basically every rule in the brand guidelines at some point or other. I always knew I was breaking it, and I was always breaking it for a reason. I mean, I think that's fine. I think when you sort of don't really realize you're breaking it, or you're not consciously breaking it, I think that's when it's...
I guess the brand guidelines one's a really interesting one, and something that, you know, we talk about a lot. And it's this idea that your tone is also an element of your brand guideline, and you can use the wrong color, you can, you know, format things slightly differently. Mm. But if the tone of what you're saying or creating is right, then that should still be distinctive to the brand.
Totally.
So.
And so many brands don't want you to like mess with the logo, but the brands that do that creatively get so much attention for like using their logo in those attention grabbing ways. Like, I guess Guinness doesn't really do it with the logo, but you know, they do it with the glass, things like that.
When that girl's going absolutely huge on TikTok by doing like
crappy versions.
And then brands were popping them on as
Microsoft. Do
mine next.
Microsoft did it.
And like everyone was absolutely like loving that.
Uber would never do that.
Yeah, I think it's that it comes back to that risk level, isn't it? Is it risky? Is it not risky? What is, you know, what's the worst? The people aren't going to forget what the Microsoft logo looks like because someone drew it badly one time.
Exactly.
Kind of basic test for like risk is just, is there a headline in a paper that someone can write? No one's anyone's really going to be like, oh, I can't believe Microsoft changed the logo on Twitter account for 24 hours.
Daily Mail.
They're not going to.
That's something to work towards, I think. Yeah, that's great coverage. Yeah. I mean, that leads us nicely onto something that we kind of spoke about off air, which is this idea, which you articulated really nicely as soft outrage. Great to hear a little bit more about what that is. And then also, how do you employ soft outrage at Surreal?
At Surreal, I don't know if I really use soft outrage. Basically, soft outrage is I don't know if it's a real term, but people on the internet love getting annoyed, right? But they'll get annoyed about anything and very much on a spectrum. So there's some stuff it's worth getting annoyed about, politics or whatever. If you took all the tone out, the comment might read exactly the same, like, this is disgusting, but they'll be talking about baked beans on something.
Yeah. Or, which is disgusting.
Or a colour scheme or the use of Comic Sans, things like that. So there's those people, things where you can get like a strong reaction from someone, but it's not really like a serious.
Yeah, but they don't mean it.
They don't care. They don't hold any little grudge to you. Like the easiest and kind of done to death one is like pineapple and pizza.
Ugh. Yeah. Or like what do you call bread in your part of the country?
If I see a brand post that now, I block them instantly. I'm like, stop.
I block friends for pulling that crap.
But those kind of things tapping into, which is basically all the blue drink did. Yeah. Like it got people
just wound
mildly,
people up. Yeah.
Got under people's skin.
That was like the most like provocative, I want to say confrontational, even though it wasn't it was the very, innocence ever been.
It was very sibling energy. Like I can imagine me and my sisters having that argument and being like, no, it is green or no, it is blue.
Yeah.
How do you, because like you've got the really light examples like the BAM cake or whatever you call it, don't come at me. You've got that on one scale. I guess, how do you find the line of what falls into jovial, no one really cares about this versus actually people might care about this? How do you kind of find that distinction? Is there an approach that you always use?
Especially when it comes to nutrition, like protein cereal, because people can get a bit about that.
Yeah, I would say generally, if it's not like a political or personal issue, most of them pretty safe. It's generally quite low risk, I would say. I mean, if we actually accidentally made a poisonous drink as a joke, just on social, we made a Conker milk.
Oh, I remember that.
Almond milk or whatever. Anyway, it turned out Conkers were poisonous. People got upset about that because they thought it was going to poison children. And so then we did like a piss take public health awareness thing about Conkers, and it worked really well, and it was all fine again. It was a scary 24 hours when I thought I was going to kill people, but whatever. What was the question?
I guess it was just about finding that line.
I guess it goes back to what I say of like, the feel like the line is normally quite further than you would think. And if you don't touch obvious risky areas, you're mostly fine. Obviously, sometimes stuff does come and surprise you. I think part of the whole strategy thing and all of that is just accepting that if you're trying to make big noise on social, sometimes it's going to go wrong and blow up in your face. You obviously can and should try to avoid it, but it is unavoidable. And so how you deal with that almost needs to be written down, or at least accepted that you accept it's going to happen, that you're not going to play blame games. And then when you're in those moments, you basically decide, have we actually done wrong? Like, do we actually care we've upset people? If yes, then you like delete and apologize and things like that. If no, then you double down. Again, innocent, we upset a bunch of COVID deniers with a parody children's book about keeping Santa safe from COVID. Suddenly, after 3 days of it just sort of doing quiet numbers on social, it landed in some like weird part of Twitter.
Found an algorithm.
And all these people were leaping on us, and we were like, fucking great, let's go. So then just spent a day arguing with COVID deniers as publicly as possible, because everyone knows they're like losers.
I guess it's that,
still
like,
mad that you were allowed to do that though, because I know some brands
allowed,
would be
no,
like,
no, not allowed. We, the words from my boss
forgiveness,
were,
not permission.
Don't tell anyone we're doing this until we've done it.
Fair enough.
Brilliant. It's interesting that we always talk about, don't you, that idea you try and push it as much as possible, and then a lot of brands fail. They may do really good at that, doing the provocation, and they found the line right, but then, you know, for whatever reason, they have to come back and be serious again. And in that moment is when they lose all credibility, because they completely forget they forget their personality, and they suddenly turn into corporate Joe again.
What I'd be worried about seeing happening, I wonder what your thoughts are on this. You know, you speak about like the ratio of product posts versus memes, etc. The ratio of soft outrage posts that would work before people started getting hard outraged. They'd be like, stop annoying me with every single post.
Stop antagonizing me.
Like Ryanair, I know theirs can't really be considered soft. The more they got praised for it, the harder that outrage got, and I think they got carried away.
So we talk about in The Simpsons how they had to keep making Homer stupider until he turned into a different
character.
So
dig your own grave a bit.
And yeah, that is sort of always the issue, where if you're always pushing stuff,
you're only known for that one thing.
You might end up having to go quite far. That just happens sometimes, doesn't it? You just have to suck it up and take a beat and be the main character for the day on the internet.
I guess all those examples, it really comes down to, is it victimless? It's not going to hurt somebody. It's not going to fundamentally change the way people think or feel about things. It's not that serious. It's not that
I was victimized by beans on Bix.
Are there any other brands or like creators, as you kind of build in, you know, what Surreal looks like on social, are there any kind of source of inspiration that you look to and thought, I'd love to kind of take a little bit of what they're doing?
I've always liked Moon Pie, who are this like American wagon wheel, but they're very like, even back in the day on like Twitter, they were much more cerebral than British brands were. So like pushed it further, just in terms of like professionalism, I would say. Spelling would be all over the place, things like that.
Yeah.
In like a good, purposeful way. And so then like when a new platform comes out, or like TikTok, which I'm still trying and failing to crack, I would still look at like what they're doing, because I know they're going to be sort of pushing stuff further than what I'm doing. And then I end up saying the same brands everyone says, so like Monzo.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Nike. That's everyone's default answer.
Monzo. Okay. I loved their one recently where they'd done year in Monzo, sort of this is how much you spent kind of thing. Fake out of home about like what people spent in different cities.
Yeah.
And obviously on LinkedIn, you get all these people treating it like it's real. Like they got all these comments about like how like the there was no logo on it. People didn't know who it came from and stuff. And
so not the marketers.
Yeah. And then they just posted it again and they were like, yeah, well, they were fake. So everyone did know who they came from.
It's Richard, isn't
but
it?
But we've made the logo much bigger now. The logo made it was massive. Like bigger than the whole person, things like that.
Yeah.
I just love those all like, this is against data protection.
It's not real, Karen.
Chill.
I do. I hope we see more of this wave of brands not taking themselves too seriously. Now I sound like a guy on Hinge. That's what I'm looking for.
I think Monzo's
don't take yourself too seriously.
It comes back to their core strategy.
They
understand what people want. Like loads of their features are real pain points that people have.
And they also have a much harder job than most people in social, because they have to apply to like
financial services
regulations. Whereas I also like Doncaster County Council on Twitter used to be very good.
Oh my God, Mill talks about them.
You would not.
I actually have heard of that. Yeah.
I don't know if they still are, because my Twitter algorithm is now a nightmare. But yeah, they used to be great.
Yeah, so our content marketer sometimes does the Social Insights episodes with me on Social Minds. She was telling me last week how she's probably going to do a LinkedIn post featuring them. So look out for that ones. We have time for just one more final question. And I think just sort of bringing it back to the beginning for some takeaways for our listeners. What do you think the key elements or components are of a product-focused post or ad post that you want to be shareable on social, crucially outside of those industry people on LinkedIn, but to, you know, the actual consumers at home who'll go and buy the products, according to Surreal's philosophy?
I mean, there's got to be an idea behind it. So you've got to be trying to do something in that like brainstorm phase. I mean, no one ever says, should we just post a picture of the product, right? But that's often
that's going to be
ends.
Like
that's
next all, week's idea. Yeah. Like, what if we did?
It's like, what if we tried X or what if we did Y? So there's got to be that kind of element of you've got an idea. Normally, you know, you'd expect humor or something surprising. It's basically idea plus something attention grabbing. I mean, especially the way algorithms work now and people's attention spans are now. I put a lot of the like percentage of the work just goes into making it visually and brainly attention grabbing. Both innocent and surreal, most captions will start with almost a header in caps to get attention. Half our ideas come from unrelated to whatever message we're trying to land, just landing on a method of getting someone's attention and putting the actual messaging later. So for instance, for a deleted tweet thing, if you see a celebrity has posted about how they've had to delete something, I might not care about that celebrity whatsoever, but I want to know what stuff they posted.
Yeah.
And so just being like, okay, that's a mechanism which gets attention, and then we can just slot the product stuff in at the end kind of thing. Either something starts with an idea for product stuff, or it starts with an idea for attention, and then you just add in the other half. If in doubt, I just use Comic Sans, because I always get
well, you heard
the
it here first.
The outrage.
Another tip, like hire talented writers like yourself. I was laughing my ass off the other day at the post you put up, and like excuses from Surreal about why you might be late to work. And I just love the way that some of the points like flowed into the other, like they were builds on the previous one. Just really natural comedic writing, which you just can't go wrong with.
Speaking your language.
Yeah, speaking my language. But no, thanks so much for coming on. Yeah, really great conversation there, and hopefully some good takeaways for our audience. And go and get yourself a bowl of protein cereal. Is it high protein, low sugar?
Money off.
Well, what a great episode. Really enjoyed that one, and I hope you did as well. I just want to talk about, I guess, loads of great points to touch on, but the one that really stuck out to me was when we were speaking about how we can work to make brands more human, whether that's through our tone of voice or the content that we put out there and the topics we talk about. But previously, we have been assigning each brand an archetype, which in essence, quite a tight box for them to work in. And as John rightly pointed out, always being happy or always being the jokester, never bringing that sort of what could be perceived as negative tone to the feed. But to your point, Jake, if we're working to make brands more human, human beings, you know, do experience the whole spectrum of emotions. It's just the way we express them, which is our distinctive personality. And I think that is and should be true for brands as well.
I think it's exactly that. It's we're speaking to an audience, like we kind of talked about, that are real. They're very in tune with their emotions, and not to get too deep, but they recognize, and you know, we've been on this wave as a society about being closer to our mental health and understanding how we feel. And this generation get that. Mm. And so they're not afraid of those things. They're not afraid of the imperfections, for lack of a better word. And I think it's not for brands to pretend to be that, but I think it's for brands to look at their audience's lives and think, where are those imperfections? And actually, where can we relate to them? Because we as the people behind the brand feel these things too. We as a brand have a reason to show up in these moments. And I think back to the archetype, when you're building a brand out, it's just allowing that flexibility and having a way to talk about the things that aren't all happy and rosy and shiny all the time without retreating into seriousness.
100%. Yeah, like there's a difference. I mean, it depends what your brand personality is, I suppose, but there's a difference between accepting what's actually going on and then just, you know, adding to doom and gloom. But I would be interested to see how many brands, you know, banning any sort of negativity in that way, but then also in their descriptors, they've got honest, and also they follow the ad age, which is meet people where they are. It's like that we're actively not doing what we know to be true.
It's a lot harder to show up in those ways, I think, is the reality. It's a lot easier to be all happy all the time because it's a role that is quite simple to play. It becomes much more nuanced when you're trying to deliver value for people. But like, think of it, I guess, like a friend. Like if you were going through something, maybe it's not that deep. Your friend's going to, you know, throw a joke in there. They're going to kind of try and bring some levity to the moment. And I think brands are so afraid of doing that because they're scared that for one person, you know, we're making fun of this moment when actually, you know, we're just experiencing it with you.
100%. Oh, you're right. It's just easier not to, which is all kinds of creatively lazy. So let's all do better.
And that actually leads into one of my key takeouts from the episode. I kind of got this feeling as we were speaking to him that creativity and this idea of being not afraid to fail is really the strategy. It was guided by a broader thought, sure. Overall, it was a sensation that, you know, you just try things and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And something we kept on saying, it's not that deep. It's not that deep. And we can go again tomorrow, and we can go again the day after that. And I think, again, some brands place so much pressure on that square box of pixels as if their entire marketing plans are going to live or die by what that content is. And maybe it will, depends how bad it is. It probably won't. And I think, you know, that agility to try new things, to see what the audience are interested, see what they respond to. That's what, for me, kind of felt like what kind of led to a lot of the success that he's experienced in his career at Innocent and also now at Surreal.
Absolutely. The more you try, the more you experiment, the more you do, the better you will be.
And also the closer you are to the ground, and you can see that people really don't give a crap about that sterile, literally sharp spin.
Totally. But hey, what we learned today is people can and do give a crap about your product and what you have to sell. Maybe in some cases more than memes that you think will be the only things that'll help you resonate. So definitely food for thought there. So I hope you all got something from that episode as well. Now, as always, we'll be back in a few weeks with Social in 6. So I'll see you then.